This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement, as we look back at the first half of a season that none of us are ever likely to forget in this most extraordinary of years. If you've been listening and subscribing since we kicked off in September, a big thank you. If you're a new listener who's got a shiny, smart device for Christmas, wherever you've been, you've missed the first 16 weeks. That's 4 months and nearly half the season. But the good news is we've got just the episode for you to try out your new Alexa or Nanopod or whatever you're listening to us on, as we bring you right up to date with all you may have missed with the very best of guests so far on the official EFL podcast. So, in the words of the great Julie Andrews, let's start at the very beginning. A very good place to start, because we kicked off proceedings in the middle of September with one of the biggest names in the Sky Bet Championship. And I wanted to know how Middlesbrough manager Neil Warnock maintains his infectious enthusiasm after all these years in the game, and after all these years of saying, "This is my last season." Neil, I know you well enough to ask you this question. Come on. You've presumably made enough money from your career. You're 71 already. You've got a lovely place down in Cornwall. You've just bought a place in northern Italy that you absolutely adore going to. Why do you want to put yourself through all this again?
I think on a Friday night, I ask myself the same question. If I'm honest. What the hell am I doing here? When my stomach's churning and I'm thinking about all the problems we've got. Big match tomorrow. Waking up Saturday morning, after having my breakfast at 9 o'clock, because I can't eat anything else till 6 o'clock after that. And I don't honestly know, Clem. I love the championship. I've got to say, and I know I've said it before about this is my last one or all sorts of things.
You've said it about 6-8 times, haven't you?
Since Sheffield United, my plan was to finish at Sheffield United 2005-06 and then have a great time, really. But I was disappointed how I left Sheffield United. I thought I was let down a little bit there. And so that made me more determined. And I'm so glad I did as well, because I love me Simon Jordan and, you know, time at Palace and QPR. I always thought below Watford was the pits. You know, you can't go down there. And they were two fantastic clubs, great fans and great times. I had great times there. So I don't think I would have come back into it. It was only the phone call from Steve, really. I've had a lot of time for Steve Gibson. He's always supported managers, and even in a difficult financial climate like this is, I've always wanted to show him what I'm about, really. I've had opportunities 2 or 3 times where I've nearly taken over the last 20 years, never really come about. And when he asked me to help him, I had a chat with Sharon, and because of the virus and everything, we're not going over to Italy at the minute or anything, so she thought it was a good idea, like I did, and I was in my car within half an hour. You know, I'm pleased. It's got me going again. I really buzz in it. I see the lads do things now and enjoying it, and that's what I want them to do. I want them to play with enjoyment and try and give as much of the club and the fans that have had all this depressive virus to deal with up here. And Middlesbrough's rife again. You know, it's a difficult place at the minute, so we want to try and put smiles on the faces if we can.
How hard do you have to work to get into the psyche of your players? Because, again, with respect, you know, you are old enough to be their granddads.
A late father, you mean, Clem? You mean a late father?
Yeah, all right, fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was in my 50s when I had my last baby.
All right, child, I did me maths, you know. Okay. I did me maths, you know what I'm saying.
All right, carry on.
But I mean, you had them all round the farm when you were down in the south.
We haven't got a farm, Clem. I've told you before, you read too many things. I have a tractor, a 1953 tractor, which is an old Massey Ferguson, which I love. I call her Bessie, and she's lovely, and I get on it now and then, and I have a few acres, but that doesn't class as a farm.
Have you got chickens?
No. Oh, got chickens, yeah. But, well, I had chickens. Unfortunately, the fox had the last lot, so we've got to reinvest in some more in the near future.
Have you got any chickens? I don't think I've ever asked that question to anyone else before, but the one thing you can always guarantee with Neil Warnock is that he'll give you a straight answer. One of the great characters in the EFL and a perfect way to kick off the season. So from a managerial legend to the new guard, the next generation, and somebody who's 30 years Neil Warnock's junior and who, after a glittering playing career, is now cutting his teeth in management. After brief spells at Crawley Town and Notts County, Harry Kuehl arrived at Boundary Park in the summer to take over as head coach of Oldham Athletic and gave us a fascinating insight into managing in Sky Bet League 2 and how it's the improvements he can see on a day-to-day basis that makes the job so rewarding.
I love it. I love going out here because you just really don't know what you're going to get. Even in training days, you just don't know what quality you're going to get.
So that's a very humble attitude to take, isn't it? Because I think there'd be other people in the game who've probably had it less than you achieved in your playing career who might have said, nah, not for me, I'm not getting my hands dirty at that level. So what has driven you to that point is, I guess, my question.
I think that the big thing is you can see a lot of differences at this level, whereas at the top level, you could work and you're really working for them 1 or 2%. Not even the 2%, it's the 1% of what you can get. And it's very hard to kind of nail it down. Whereas at this level here, you can kind of change the whole culture, the way that players see the game, adapt to the game. And I think the percentages are a lot higher. I felt even at my last few clubs that I saw a difference from the first time I went in there to when I had left, that the players had risen either 10 to 15% in only in their own standard. So that's what I like.
I get it. So what you're basically saying is, because I've been lucky enough to watch you in a training session when you were at Notts County, you're very immersive, you're in the thick of it, your own energy pours out, but you're saying you get those big gains in players. You can see those differences straight away by working with them at that kind of level. That's part of the buzz for you.
Oh, it's definitely a buzz. But again, a lot of these players, I kind of feel for, because everyone kind of thinks, oh, well, they're League Two, they're no good, they're past it, or they've never made it. I mean, a lot of these players have been at top academies, may have had a misunderstanding through their career that have put them down at different levels, may have had injuries to get back. But every player that I have come across in my three clubs, bar one or two, they've all wanted to learn. And they've all loved playing the normal style of football again. And that's what's nice. They're here, they want to play. And I actually think you're actually seeing more teams as well trying to play the right way now than they were, say, let's say 20 years ago. So I even take my hat off to a lot of the managers now, because, again, the kind of pressure we put on our fullbacks or our centre-backs or our holding midfielders now to get the ball and turn out like the top teams do, It takes courage, because the top players are obviously used to it, but these players are starting to learn it. And when you do see players do your movements or they stick to your plan, it's like I said, it's such a buzz, a joy. I always said I could never ever get that feeling again of scoring. So when you score a goal, everyone always asks, what's the feeling like? And it's this, I don't know, it's like this inside, it's like euphoria, it's like everyone's watching you, it's an amazing feeling. And I thought, well, since I've stopped playing football now, you know, you don't get that buzz. But I always remember my first goal that Crawley scored for me, I had that feeling. And every time my team scores, I have that feeling. Even though I didn't score it or anything, but it's part of what we've worked on during the week. And like I said, it's even better than me actually scoring.
This is the official EFL podcast.
Well, that is quite a statement, isn't it? And we wish Harry and his coaching team all the very best of luck for the second half of the season. I did also point out to him that only remote parts of Siberia feel colder than Boundary Park in the bleak midwinter, but Harry assured me he's got a decent coat. From coats to anoraks and the weird and wonderful world of football trivia and statistics, it may sound like the sort of thing that would facilitate you swapping seats at a dinner party, but October this year marked the 200,000th professional league game in English football, and we delved into a whole world that few of us are familiar with. Times columnist Bill Edgar approaches football slightly differently to the rest of us, and for those of you asking, yes, he is married.
I've got a file of kind of stats that might come off or will definitely come off in 6 months' time when these two particular managers meet, because they were both born in the same town and both did something else, you know. But I remember last season, again, when I was hoping it would come off. So Alain Saint-Maximin was up against, if I got it right, Newcastle against Sheffield United. So he was up against Dean Henderson, the Sheffield United goalkeeper. And I'd seen that they were born not only the same birthday, but born on the very same day. So I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if Saint-Maximin scored against Henderson? And sure enough, it did happen. And so I again went to the National Football Archive people who I mentioned earlier. So when did this last happen, that a player scored against a goalkeeper who was born on the very same day? And they were able to say, oh, yes, 18 years ago, this player did it again. It was a lower division player. I can't remember off the top of my head. But this was the last time. And the last happened in the top flight was in the 1950s sometime. So yes, you've got all these stats ready. So, I mean, it's not like I suddenly start to write my column for Monday and just come up with them straight away. I'm kind of thinking about it the whole time. So I'll be watching a match on a midweek and I'll think, oh, that's interesting, or that could lead to something. So, and then as the week goes on, I'll look into it, and then the weekend matches happen. I'll say, oh, yes, that did happen. That was what I was hoping, and then put it in that way. So as I said earlier, my whole working life is just spent thinking about football from a kind of a sort of quirky perspective and sort of sometimes significant perspective, but all statistics there.
Yeah. I mean, the young bucks are sort of heading in your direction as well, aren't they? Because there's a lot of young statisticians around football clubs now looking in unsubscribed markets for potential transfer targets, the whole money ball thing that kind of came in. So it's becoming more and more prevalent and very, very much leaving the anorak on the back of the washhouse door and moving into the realms of a smart suit.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, that and those sort of people, they're looking very much into the significant side of facts. You know, clubs will pay somebody a fortune to identify a left back who will slot into their team because of his ability to run, I don't know, 57 sprints every game or something. You know, so you could scientifically could be pinned down to something very important. Obviously, they're not going to be paying people a fortune to reveal that he would be the, you know, Manchester City. If you sign him, he's the 12th player called Brown that you've had in your history or something like that. So yeah, those people, they're on the significant side of things. So, which again, I'm interested in. When I write my column, I like to mix it up. So there is a mixture. So for example, this last weekend with the drama of the Premier League on Sunday, when Liverpool and Manchester United both conceded 7 and 6. So it was the first time ever that they'd conceded 6 or more goals on the same day. And the first time ever they had 5 goal defeats or more on the same day. So that's obviously significant. So as I put those sort of things in, but then at the same time, I like to kind of throw in quirky ones as well to mix it up, you know.
It's certainly a different way of looking at things, but without statisticians like Bill Edgar, we wouldn't have these milestones and be able to celebrate the rich sporting history that we have in this country. And one man who's certainly achieved his fair share of milestones and notable statistics is the former Nottingham Forest and Wales goalkeeper Mark Crossley, amid more than 450 appearances for club and country during a playing career that spanned more than 3 decades. However, as we all know, personal struggles with mental health can affect us all, regardless of who we are or what we have. And in a year when events sadly combined to tip him over the edge, Mark explains how he sought help for the sake of himself and his family as he continues to cope with life after football. Go on, tell us about it. Just take us through your year.
January the 2nd, manager who I've always worked with, John Sheridan, he was relieved of his duties at Chesterfield, and I went with him, basically. And it's the first time it had ever happened to me where I'd been relieved of a job in football, having spent 33 years full-time in it. So for me, the norm was go back pre-season, do pre-season, have your all. It's a routine that you're in. And I was in that routine. It's the first time I'd ever been pulled out of it. Now, although I was ready for the break from it, for family reasons, I wanted to spend more time with my family and football. The world revolves around you when you're in football, whether it's playing, coaching, anything. But you don't realise how other people suffer in that environment. So I got the sack, basically, along with John, 2nd of January, week after my dad got diagnosed with cancer. Me and my dad are really, really close. And I understand loads of people, the C word, it happens in life to loads of people. But I didn't handle it very well. And things were suffering at home. Two young boys, 9-year-old, 3-year-old. And when my wife actually sat me down and said, these kids are not seeing the dad, plus getting the sack, plus the dad with cancer, I just turned into not Mark Crossley. I can't explain why, but I did. And I had to find something. I locked myself in the bedroom for a couple of days. I just didn't want to see anybody, you know. And what I didn't realise is I was suffering from depression. So I seeked help. I went for help and I got help because I definitely needed it because I wasn't me.
I don't want to dwell on the lowest point, but what was not Mark Crossley? Were you acting uncharacteristically? You already said you were hiding away to an extent. Can you, for those that have been lucky enough to never experience depression, can you describe what you went through?
I'd got nothing to get up for normally getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning, leaving for work, getting back at 7 at night. I wasn't focused on the most important things in my life, which is your family. I was just focusing. I'd always focused on football and trying to get to an age to eventually be able to retire. Now, I reached that age, but once I come out of it, I couldn't deal with it. I just couldn't deal with the situation. I couldn't deal with what I was missing, normal routine that I'd been in for the last 33 years. Although I had said to myself that I wanted the break, I couldn't deal with the situation. And I'm a deep thinker. I've always been a guy who's glass half empty rather than half full. Why? I don't know. But I have always been that type of guy. I've always planned ahead. So I've always had a 5-year plan, whether we're in coaching, where do you want to be, what do you want to do? And when that all of a sudden just goes, and I just turned into not being myself, and it caused so many problems at home that I didn't see and I didn't realise. I'd already lost one marriage and I was nearly going to lose another one.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
October was Black History Month, and we were lucky enough to be joined by English football legend Luther Blissett, who described with great power how difficult it was for a young black footballer in the 70s and 80s dealing with the racial abuse he faced from the terraces, and how we must all learn from our history to bring about real change and eliminate racial prejudice in sport and in society as a whole.
It was a difficult thing to walk out on a football pitch as a black footballer back then because of the abuse that you generally got every time you walked out onto the pitch. People were very, worried or just a little bit scared, I suppose, of because you look different. And people, I think as human beings, we tend to fear something that's different rather than try and find out and get to know it. We tend to fear it first. And I think that's the position we're all in. And a lot of that came out with the abuse that they shouted at us because our skin colour was different, and it just gave them licence to behave in that sort of very unhuman way.
Well, I mean, that's the tribal element of football, isn't it? But was that reflective of society at the time? Was it?
Oh, absolutely.
So it was tough to walk down the street back then?
It was. In certain areas where I lived in Wilson, it got a lot better. You know, there was a lot of Irish there and obviously a lot of English people there. So it was much better, but it wasn't like, I know a lot of people had it a lot worse than I did. And you had the odd remark when I was growing up that you'd come across. But generally, it was only until you got to school and started to play football at different schools up and down the country that you realised how really entrenched that attitude was with the British people. The name calling and stuff, you know, it hurt, but, you know, you put it behind you and it never leaves you, because that is an emotional, and that is one of those mental things that will never go. And it's how you manage that. And for myself, I could think about the saying, you know, sticks and stone, but names do hurt. And I think this is something that a lot of people learn as you go on through life. It does hurt. And that's what we need to stop, is people actually feel it's okay for them to say whatever they choose, because you said it back to them and they didn't like it. You know, occasionally one or two players would say to me when they've caught me late or whatever, you know, on the floor, and they say, there's more of that coming, you black so-and-so, while you're on the floor. You know, when I let them have one back, you know, I would sort of then, you know, we can keep doing this, you white so-and-so, or we can just play football.
I guess you still feel that sense of responsibility to explain what it was like, to be open about what you went through and to help that education process.
Well, the thing is, we can't and should never just push history to one side. It's your history what makes you who you are. And it's same with clubs. Clubs have a history, whether it be good, bad or indifferent, and usually it covers all of these things. And you should never, ever just push that to one side, because it's the history that makes you who you are. Hopefully you've learned from a lot of things that haven't been good, and you've improved things and made your club a certain way. And certain people that have come through the club, players or managers, coaches, chairman or whatever, have all done amazing things to get clubs to where they are in their little way as they go along. So it's important that we acknowledge the history of where we've come from, the good times and the bad times and the indifferent times. We need to understand all of these things, because that helps us to be better going forward. And hopefully a lot of the mistakes of the past we won't make as we go on.
Have you ever, in conversations with the current generation, for example, of players, has anybody ever thanked you for the role that you played in being a pioneer in breaking down barriers? Has anybody ever acknowledged that?
No, nobody's ever done that to my face. But I think the thing that modern players are, and I think it's modern youth and the way society is, you know, people only, and I think I was probably the same when I was playing. I was very focused on doing everything that I could for my career to further my, get my career moving forward. And I think these players look at it and they have not acknowledged they are unaware, I think, of what has enabled them to now be part of a football club and look around and be players there of different nationalities, players there of different religions. The cultures are all different. Whereas when I started playing, you know, there was Scottish, there was Welsh, there was Irish, there was English players. That was it. So it was all homegrown players there at the time. And now players from all over the world, and nobody gives it a second thought. Nobody gives it a second thought if you see somebody signs a black player and has spent £50 million on him. Nobody goes, I can't believe I spent £50 million. You don't get that. Because what they see is a footballer, somebody that hopefully comes to their club and can contribute and to help them get success. And nobody looks at that anymore. And I think a lot of the current players need to think back and think, those guys that went through this, and there's a lot of people that went through far worse than I did. And I look at them, and people like Viv Anderson playing that first game for England, you know, the one to break the barrier initially, was amazing for me, because once he did that, I can do that. And that was the big, big thing about the statement that was made by when he did that. So a lot of current players need to sometimes just look back and look at the history of their club, their country, and how football has been and what people have had to overcome to get to the stage where now they can go out and do what they do and earn the money that they earn. And nobody begrudges at them because of the colour of their skin.
Luther, I'm really sorry about a big chunk of the subject matter of this discussion, but thanks for allowing us to celebrate.
Clem, it's important that this topic is spoken about all the time, not only in Black History Month. We do it once a year, and it's something that should be discussed all the time because it's a very important subject. I've discovered things in this past, since we've been in this pandemic, of players, people that have managed, of colour, have managed, whether it be in rugby or whether it be in football, whatever, in this country, which I knew nothing about. And that's why history is very important, so we understand where we've come from and what we've had to go through. We had this thing where people want to tear down statues and rename streets and all that sort of thing. Now, for me, that is completely wrong. History is important because we look at it and say, why did that happen? Why was this person you know, in the time that they were. And again, we've got to look at the time when these things happened, when it was slavery and all that sort of thing, why these people did what they did, because it was a norm. Not say it was right, it was a norm. And we have to put things in, you know, look at within the context of when they happened and what the world and the life was like. And I think we sometimes sit here now and judge things that have gone in the past, which is not absolutely right, because that's like hindsight. In hindsight, you're never wrong. Well, shouldn't be anyway.
The quite brilliant Luther Blissett talking so honestly, openly and eloquently. Such a fantastic guest, and we've been blessed with a whole array of those so far this season, with one of my all-time favourites being the Wycombe Wanderers manager, Gareth Ainsworth. I always look forward to interviewing Gareth, and our official EFL podcast chat fell straight off the back of one of the most dramatic weeks of his life that saw him rush to hospital for an urgent operation while his team recorded their first win of the season. Gareth somehow managed to combine the two events like nobody else I know. And as you can imagine, he tells the story perfectly.
I was feeling great on the day of the Watford game, did a session in the gym, ran up the stairs at the training ground. And as I went up the stairs, as I always do, the life and soul and the energy of the training ground, something popped really, really bad in my back. Something popped and it was like, wow, that wasn't good. And straight away, it wasn't a problem. I did that game that night, the Watford game on TV, and the interviewers were saying, oh, we know you've got a bad back, we know you're struggling. And I was walking around very gingerly. I wasn't, first time I've ever sat down, I think, on a bench for any game. And then the next day and the next day after that, it just got worse and worse. I had a scan. They said, look, you need an operation on the Wednesday. And we said, right, let's book that operation in as soon as we can. We've got the international break coming. We'll do it then. And on the Thursday, Clem, total collapse, paralysis in my left leg. It's not a nice thing to describe to people, but I was lying on the living room floor here and I couldn't move. What had happened was a prolapse disc had become detached and went into my spinal cord. And so it was a serious issue that I called on our fabulous NHS. Again, I was clapping them for the COVID. I can clap them even more now because they've saved me. The Chrome ambulance into hospital, Royal Berkshire in Reading, and within 12 hours I'm having surgery to remove this disc from the spinal cord. And it was a real tough one, you know, a couple of hours operation, but all fit and good now. Still a bit numb down the left leg, but you know, thank goodness they found it, they stopped it, and they saved it. So yeah, anyone who's got back problems, go and get it checked out, because I tell you what, you don't want to go through what I went through.
So the operation was on which day of the week? The Friday. So you were able to get home in time to watch the boys get the first win?
No, I watched it in hospital. So
on your iPad, in a sort of general ward or what?
On my iPhone. So now my eyes have gone now because I'm trying to squint at this iPhone. But no, it was on the iPhone. I'd come round. I was pumps full of codeine and whatever else you need to keep the pain away. But no, we went through the tactics on the Thursday. I was still in total contact with my assistant. I was ringing my analyst during the game. And so
ringing your analyst during the game from your hospital bed, still coming out of your anaesthetic, straining your eyes, trying to influence it. From a hospital bed. Were you on a general ward with about three or four other beds in there, or did they put you in room?
I was lucky I had a little side room there, because I don't know what I was saying, but I'm sure it was gibberish to some people. But no, yeah, I remember ringing the analyst at half time and saying, look, midfield looks a little bit leggy. I said, we're looking a little bit leggy in midfield. And Josh, my analyst, said, Richard Dobson, my assistant, he said, Dobbo's mentioned that. And within 10 minutes, he took one of our midfielders off and replaced him. And I thought, do you know what? I'd have done that. So it's just signs that out together, the 9 years that we've been together for me in charge, we just think the same anyway, you know. So I'm in total trust of what's going on. But I don't know. I can't recall too many conversations that day, but I remember a 1-0 win, and that got us off the mark in the championship.
So by the time we came round to the midweek win at Birmingham, were you able to influence and interfere that little bit more? I mean, I got to reflect as well, because Paul Warren talked about he had to COVID isolate and watched in his man shed and things. And he said that the pictures were about 45 seconds later than the relay was getting down the phone line from the game.
I've got a great story from last night. So we get to the week and with the build up to Birmingham. And again, on the Tuesday, I'm FaceTiming Dobbo, and he's got his FaceTime pointed at the tactics board behind him, and was moving these counters about. And so we picked the team together, we picked the tactics, and on a true story, and he's saying, what about this and what about that? I'm saying, yep. So we get to, I mean, it's always together. I always have the final say on everything, no matter what, but there's always a debate, and I like to be challenged. So he's saying this. And so we settle on a team. We get the team out there, and pretty much the same team. They get out there, and then on the night, obviously, Richard's—he's the one there. He's on the—he's touchline. If he feels anything, I give him my blessing to make subs and do what he feels is right on the night, because we've been together so long. So, anyway, we go 1-0 down. Obviously, first half. So I ring Josh again, because Dobbo's got this headpiece in, and he's directly linked to Josh. So I can ring Josh rather than ringing Dobbo and him having a phone on the touchline, which looks a bit rubbish. I ring Josh, direct feed into him. So I ring Josh half time. We're talking about the tactics, and we changed again, and we get back in it. And I don't know if you know the game, but last night we were at Birmingham. Akin Fenwood was just sat on the edge of their box. We were just pumping balls into him, and everything was sticking, and Birmingham couldn't get out. And it was a great performance, a great Wickham performance second half, and we were playing. So I ring him about, I don't know, 85 minutes or something. I rang him earlier in the after. I said, keep it going, Josh. Just tell Dobbo, don't change anything. Keep this going. I can feel it. I don't know if you can see what I'm seeing on the screen, but this is looking good. We're going to nick something. And Josh just goes, it's in, Gaffer. And I'm watching the screen, and there's nothing happening. And I'm thinking, what the hell are you talking about? There's nothing happening here. And then 45 seconds later, I see it all on the screen. So that's like a bit of an anti-climax now, because I know we've scored. And he's going, yeah, it's in, Gaffer. It's counted. The referees give it. And I'm going, what? Just show me. So it was honestly a brilliant moment that Josh is this 22 to 23-year-old analyst. He's been absolutely brilliant, but his enthusiasm. And I'm wondering now what the other people next to him were thinking, that he's shouting, screaming now that it's in, Gaffer, it's in. And what a finish to the game, you know, last minute winner. Can't get any better. And really fun.
This is the official EFL podcast.
I still can't quite believe he was coaching from his hospital bed while coming round from anaesthetic. It was all change at Bournemouth in the summer as long-serving manager Eddie Howe left the club after their relegation from the Premier League, granting his former number two, Jason Tindall, the opportunity to take over the reins and steer them towards the goal of automatic promotion from the Sky Bet Championship at the first attempt. So far, it's all been going pretty much according to plan, but there was quite a bit of adjusting for both him and his squad to prepare for their latest challenge, as Jason explains.
Everything that happened so quickly, in the sense that, you know, we got relegated from the Premier League, probably unexpectedly. And then the quick turnaround. So you're going from, you're getting relegated in the Premier League to a couple of weeks later, you're back preparing for the start of a championship season, and you know, no one would have wanted to get relegated. A lot of staff lost their jobs, and a lot of players left the football club. And the current group of players that have been in the Premier League for so long, obviously that's where they wanted to be and where they wanted to stay. And I think you have to almost pick people up off the floor, so to speak, because of the disappointment that they've just had. And obviously with Eddie no longer the manager as well, and question marks over myself and what that's going to be like. I think it was, you know, it's certainly probably the toughest challenge to start with, to get everybody, you know, sort of fully focused on the job in hand and you know, sort of almost forgetting what's happened in the past and now sort of focusing on the now and the future. And you know, I think the early results maybe helped that.
I mean, so you're chucked right in at the deep end, because presumably with a mix of personalities, you know, as you've already said, they want to be playing in the Premier League, but you quickly have to decide who's definitely going, who you think you can work on and persuade to stay and stay within budget. There might be some of those that maybe can't be moved on, but have to stay in the squad. That's not just technical prowess on the football field, Jason, is it? You're immediately thrown into man management and in a big, deep way.
Yeah, and I think that was the biggest challenge for me initially was that, you know, because as I said, got relegated and a lot of the players want to play in the Premier League and that's where they still want to be. So, you know, you got the disappointment of them, they want to get back there, and then you've got the speculation linking a lot of players sort of away from the football club, and you're dealing with that as well as all the other sort of, you know, then as manager, you're dealing with all the staff that have, you know, unfortunately lost their jobs, and a lot of uncertainty in terms of what's going on. So, yeah, that was certainly the biggest challenge I've probably had to face. And then you're having to let players know that there's no longer a contract sort of here for them that have been at the club for so long is almost some of your first decisions that you're having to make. So it was a
club legends as well, Jason. Absolute club legends. People that have been on this incredible journey with you, Charlie Daniels, Andrew Sermon, etc. I mean, people that whose names will resonate with the club for ages.
Yeah, and one of my first meetings was with Simon Francis, which was difficult. Yeah. But it was where the club was, and you know it fell on my shoulders at the time in terms of moving forward and what I felt was best for the club and the squad moving forward. And as a manager, you have to make some big calls and some tough decisions, and I was aware of that. I know that, and you know it's part and parcel of the job.
Yeah, have you had to add certain aspects to your own personality? Have you had to make certain adjustments? Because I guess you're overturning the perception that you're a specialist number two. So there's that kind of stuff floating around. Maybe I always had the perception that you and Eddie as well were good cop, bad cop. Can you guess which one I thought you were? So have you had to switch to being good cop? You know, there's all this stuff as well, isn't it? This changing dynamic, or isn't there? Am I overcomplicating it?
Do you know what, Clem? It's obviously I had all these questions even before I took the job in how you're going to be and how you're going to act and this, that, and the other. But you know, I said to myself on taking the job, I need to be myself. I can't change from the person I am. The second I try and be someone different and act in a different way, I'm not being myself, and you know people will see through that. So, although I was I was assistant manager for a long time at the football club, I had a very good relationship with the players. But even in that role, I don't think you can become too close to them. Even as an assistant manager, you could. You know, I've got a great relationship where I can sit down and talk to him about football, about personal stuff and life in general. But I never allowed myself to get too close where, you know, I almost they see me as a friend. And I think even now, I'm the same person. I talk to him, you know, I've got to make big decisions and leave some players out. And at the same time, if there's problems at home or in life in general, I have to sit down and have a cup of tea with them and talk about life. So I haven't had to change, and I made that decision myself. I wasn't going to change the person that I am.
Next up, a pair of young guns who prove that despite all their goal-scoring success for their respective clubs, it's the women in their lives who are in charge of things at home. First up, Barnsley striker Corley Woodrow, whose mum Lynn makes a surprise appearance, and then Exeter City midfielder Jake Taylor, who describes the difficulties of combining football with getting married, although you notice he makes sure he keeps his voice down so his new wife Catherine doesn't hear him. As a goal scorer, is the whole sort of rhythm of your life affected by what sort of run of form you're in, i.e. if you're scoring regularly, you're happy as Larry. And if you're not, you're a real grouch around home and, you know, everybody has to avoid you and stuff.
Yeah, exactly that. I think my missus and my mum and stuff, they know that if I don't score, it could be in a bad mood. So yeah, like you say, obviously as a striker, you want to score goals and you're obviously judged on goals. So when you do go a period without scoring, it's disappointing, but you've also got to sort of stick with it and keep working hard, because you'll know that you'll sorry, my mum just walked in the room.
Has she?
I'm joking.
Does she not? Yeah, can you just shout? You're doing it in the middle of an interview, mum. What's your mum called?
Lynn, she's gone now. Sorry about
that. Is she? Okay, fine. What, she thought you were just on the phone to one of your mates, did she?
I don't know what she thought. I said, don't come in, but she just walked in.
Okay, that's good. We are recording this, and obviously it will crop up on the official EFL podcast Christmas bloopers tape. When Lynn walked in and Corley was in mid-sentence. Listen, I'm going to let you go because I'm frightened that your mum's going to burst in again with another job she needs to do or wants to get you to do something.
I think she wants me to do a dishwasher, I think.
Oh, is that what it is? Oh, fantastic. Give our love to Lynn, won't you? Tell her to let you have a rest because it's your day off tomorrow, so we don't want you over doing it. Great to talk to you, mate.
Top man, mate. Thanks a lot.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Whatever the story of your week, good or bad, you will struggle to match the narrative of the one Exeter City's captain had at the end of last month. Jake Taylor scored in a comeback win on a Tuesday, got married on a Wednesday, had his honeymoon of sorts on a Thursday, went back to training on Friday, scored in another win on Saturday. And the first thing I thought, Jake, when I heard about this story was how very tolerant the new Mrs. Taylor actually is to allow her wedding to be sort of bracketed by football.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair play to her for sort of, you know, there's been a lot written about it so far. And to be fair, most of the headlines are more about me scoring a few times in a week than actually getting married. So, yeah, obviously it was a fantastic week, and it was topped off by having some really good results on the football pitch as well, which always helps.
Listen, you were recording this at home. She's working upstairs. You better keep your voice down, and you better frame this story to slightly more to marital bliss as it goes on. What's the lovely lady's name, please? Other than Mrs. Taylor, obviously.
It's Catherine Taylor. Yeah, so Catherine, which still sounds a little bit strange for me, anyway.
Yeah, I guess it would do. I mean, I also thought to myself, what a blooming good job you did come back in that game on Tuesday night, because you footballers don't take well to losses and do sometimes need 24 hours, 48 hours to get them out of your system, don't you?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think even on the Tuesday during the day, I sort of had so much stuff to sort out for the actual day on the Wednesday. It sort of took my mind off it a little bit, which, you know, maybe helped settle my nerves slightly. But yeah, it was obviously coming back and winning and scoring. Yeah, obviously we were all in a really positive spirit anyway, and that just sort of topped it off. I think it might have been a little bit different if we had, lost that game. It's difficult for footballers to sort of go home and switch off sometimes, but I don't think I would have, been able to go into my wedding with a bit of, dampened spirits. But yeah, it really did work out pretty perfectly.
When you're getting married and you're having that day off Thursday, honeymoonish, sort of curtailed, whatever you want to call it, rest over from whatever you did on the Wednesday, no need to go into the detail, it's a family podcast. Could you get the football out of your head as well? Right, we're playing them at the weakest. But, you know, by Thursday, you're normally thinking, right, I'm going to be up against him and this is what's going to happen, etc.
Yeah, it was definitely difficult. The manager was really good with me. He said after the game on the Tuesday that, I could have the Thursday off and that to come in Friday. So it sort of gave me an extra day to sort of celebrate with my family that had come down and obviously my partner's family who had come down. And then, yeah, as soon as sort of Thursday night came where, people were having a few drinks, it was important for me to sort of, get back into football mode and realise we had another big game on the weekend. So, yeah, obviously I'm going to, have a proper celebration soon. But yeah, it was important for me to sort of switch back into football mode and concentrate on the job ahead.
And how long have you two been together, if you don't mind me asking? Let's just get the basics of the relationship sorted.
7 years we've been together, so
What took you so long, Jake, to pop the question?
She asked me that for about 6 years, she did, so...
Careful, mate, be very careful.
My sister got married a couple of summers ago, so that sort of... I didn't want to sort of steal their thunder, so that bided me a little bit of time. And then, you know, once that was out of the way, I didn't really have any excuse. So that's what I tell her anyway.
Well, listen, congratulations from us. Love to Catherine.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I suspect Jake will not be playing that interview to Catherine. So a few weeks ago, we were lucky enough on the Official EFL podcast to be joined by a musical artist who's making quite a mark in the charts at the moment. After the huge success of his debut album, he's back with a long-awaited seasonal follow-up. And when you think of great singers who also know a thing or two about the beautiful game, you think of Chris Kamara. Album number one, a great success. Out comes album number two, and it's filled with, well, first tracks, I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day, I Believe in Father Christmas, actually, In the Bleak Midwinter makes it onto this one, various other tracks. Of course, our stingy producer, Dave, has worked out the only way we can use certain tracks on this podcast for overseas rights and all that is he's had to pick the ones he says are out of copyright or something or other. So I tell you what, let's have a blast. Let's play a little bit of White Christmas if we can. Let's have a little bit of a listen. Here we go.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
Is it, do you, you know, when you're now doing it, does it feel a little bit like you are singing in the shower and things? I mean, is it just most natural? No, seriously, did you have to try extra hard, or does that just come naturally to you?
No, it's been difficult. That's the one thing I have to say is, you know, I thought I could sing before. And I think everybody else is the same. You know, you think you can sing, you sing along on the karaoke or in a bar or whatever you do, and you think you sound absolutely fantastic until you meet a singing coach who educates you and tells you, you know, staccato and legato. I thought they were two Italian footballers.
Well, that just about wraps it up, but we couldn't end this seasonal special without having Cammy play us out with another Christmas classic. So to finish, the only thing that will always carry on is our producer Dave will always be a little tight-wadded, shall we say. So let's see if he's got any budget left, because I would like to fade you out with your beautiful version of O Come All Ye Faithful.
Play it, I'll sort it.
O come all ye faithful, joyful and triumphant, come ye, oh come ye to Bethlehem. Come and behold him, born the King of angels. Oh come, let us adore him. Oh come, let us adore him. Oh come, let us adore him. Christ the Lord.
Shall we leave him to it? I think we should. That's it for another week, and indeed for 2020. Huge thank you to all the guests who've joined us so far this season. We're already looking forward to chatting to the biggest names in the Sky Bet Championship, League One and League Two, when we return in 2021. If you've enjoyed this week's episode, then please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button, and please share on all your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Wishing you a happy and slightly less challenging new year.
The Official EFL Podcast.